financial independence, country shopping, van nomadism, security culture, ethical enclaves, crypto anarchy, legal interstices, survivalism. Join your host Shane and Kyle as they explore this freedom strategy known as Vonnie. You're listening to the Vonnie Podcast.
And welcome to the Vonnie Podcast, the podcast making you invulnerable to coercion. That is, at least when you get to the action portion. Nonetheless, I'm Shane and...
Kyle.
You're strange. Very strange. Although I guess the variety is maybe entertaining for the listeners. I don't know.
Variety is the spice of life.
Very good. Well, we're certainly glad you decided to join us today, and we hope you've had a great week. And Kyle, why don't you go ahead and bipcot this thing for us?
Since governments are the primary coercers upon individuals, the Vonnie Podcast is covered by a bipcot no government license. Reuse and modification is permitted to anyone except for governments and the agents thereof. You can learn more at bipcot.org.
Well done. Well done. But yeah, I added that little beginning part to the license to make it, you know, unique to Vonnie and all of that with, invulnerability to coercion and all that good stuff. But very good. This episode is entitled A Primer on the Servile Society, and the show notes can be found at VonniePodcast.com/9. So let's get right into this. And since you're in the, I guess you can call it the hot seat this week, you're Mr. Definition Man. So let's go ahead and define some terms first. We'll define servile society, import-export, and one-directional isolationism. So, Kyle, what is the servile society?
I guess you could say that a servile society could be defined as one that does not respect self-ownership or individual liberty, but rather heralds the supremacy of government and authority. So, in other words, it upholds the collective as superior to the individual. If you think about it, every aspect of the servile society is oriented towards unmitigated subservience towards those, shall we say, malfunctioning individuals who falsely imagine themselves to be our rulers. So regardless of the specific flavor of authoritarianism, I think it would be fair to say that a key recurring theme of the servile society is that blind obedience to the state is considered to be a virtue.
Very good. Yeah, that's what about import-export?
Well, I guess the short, concise, and sweetly put way of putting it is that import-export is a way of concisely explaining how Vonnuans, defined, of course, as those who have an invulnerability to coercion, relate to the servile society. So to maybe explain this a little bit more, the import part of it would be that they are importing knowledge and goods, perhaps other things as well, into their Vonnuums, the place or situation of an invulnerability to coercion, like their shelters of one kind or another.
Home bases, yeah.
Mm-hmm, sure. And that itself is kind of its own topic, right? But they're importing goods and knowledge and perhaps some other things, and they export their labor as well as, whenever they get around to it, products back out to the servile society, especially if they have like a home-based business or something to that effect. So import-export is the idea of importing goods and knowledge and exporting labor and products.
Yes, yes. And we'll get more into this in a moment, but I think it is worth mentioning here that the reason Rayo kind of formulated this was because it's very, very hard, especially, you know, early on. It might even be impossible to, you know, as he kind of did, you know, move out in the woods and living under a polyethylene A-tent. I mean, it's very, very hard to, you know, be completely self-sufficient out there. So, you know, importing and exporting with the servile society is kind of necessary, you know, in regards to Vonnie. So what about one-directional isolationism?
So one-directional isolationism, I guess you could say, is how import-export actually works. So one-directional isolation of import-export is used to maintain access to the servile society's, shall I say, open but not free trading centers, yet simultaneously denying them access to a Vonnuan's home through, again, importing goods and knowledge while exporting labor or products back out to the servile society. So if you think about like the old English common law adage of a man's home is his castle, that's kind of a very simple way of understanding one-directional isolationism. So to also kind of use a parallel example regarding legal interstices, people are familiar with search warrants and stuff. That's kind of like a legal interstice in a manner of speaking. Again, see previous episode on that. Again, with one-directional isolationism as part of VANU, which is about practicality, not legality, the idea of import-export is how do you actually maintain that one-directional isolationism to keep out coercers of one flavor or another? You know, maybe one particular way of doing that in terms of hardening your home would be maybe having a security setup or some other things. But at least in terms of import-export, it's a way of conceptualizing how the Nuans can be the Nuans and have integrity in doing so while still maintaining trade with the servile society and yet not compromise on their principles.
Indeed, indeed, and well said. So, Wayne, as we do in every single podcast, it's important to look at what Rayo actually said about the concepts that we're presenting here in the VANU podcast. So we'll start with this one. Quote, "An optimally liberated lifestyle must involve a sort of one-directional isolation. The liberator maintains his access to their open but not free trading centers while denying them access to his home. This requires a skillful blend of concealment and deception, plus perhaps elements of mobility and deterrence. A free man obtains information, techniques, key equipment, and supplies out of the servile society, exporting labor or products in return. And during import-export activities, he practices deception, perhaps carries a driver's license, genuine or faked, perhaps pays some sales taxes he cannot conveniently avoid. But the free man's home base is physically concealed. There he spends most of his time. There he may sleep, imbibe, love, design, build, trade with fellow freemen, and raise children in relative safety from the savages of state. A free man's home must be a figurative castle," end quote. And that's from October 7th, or that article is written in October 7th of 1970, in page 15 of Rayo's book. So I guess let's provide some examples on what a home base would look like. So I think a home base, and obviously we'll get more into as we, you know, provide some examples of, you know, more, I guess, productive home bases versus, you know, ones that are more for like relaxation. So, you know, comfortable living versus like industry and things of that nature. But Kyle, I think Aurora and Alongside Night could serve as one example. So if you haven't watched the movie, I'd recommend you go do it. It's free on YouTube. But you'll notice they have early warning systems. I remember one time in the movie when, they were vulnerable to coercion. And what did they do? Well, they had an early warning system that alerted all of the occupants. And the traders in the market that it's about time to jump ship as is said, and they had their secure home bases too. I mean, that's where they lived, so they were secure. They had a system to get them out of there safely, and they did have light to heavy industry. I mean, it's essentially like if you envision a shopping mall, that's kind of the kind of what it was. So it wasn't 500 by 500 square foot tiny house. This was like a pretty massive, structure. So this would be more like a light and heavy industry in Rayo's Meantime to Harassment Spectrum, which we'll discuss next week. So just kind of table that for now. But Kyle, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a example taken straight out of libertarian fiction. And Aurora in Alongside Night was pretty much, it was carried accurately, from the actual novel that, of course, I wrote a book report on, obviously, as these things go. So, yes, when there was an event, not to spoil the plot too much, but just to describe the context of this scene so that the listeners can really understand what was going on in case they haven't read the book or watched the movie Alongside Night by J. Neil Shulman. It's just simply this. The statists found the underground market, or a underground market, this particular one being codenamed Aurora, that was trading in all sorts of stuff that, let's just say, it's just a little bit black market. Obviously,
nuclear weapons and shit, yeah.
Oh, and there was cannabis, and there was all sorts of things. Yeah, I mean, we're talking like multiple life sentences, if not a death sentence, if anybody was caught and convicted, okay? Let me put it that way. And I don't think juries are going to nullify anytime soon. But yeah, you look at Aurora and, it was kind of like, well, an underground shopping mall in a manner of speaking. And there was also, it was a pretty interesting complex. Like there was like, there were dining areas. They had their own like anarcho bank type thing, I think it was called, their own currency exchanges. They had kind of almost like a YMCA type complex with like gyms and saunas and swimming pools. Actually, one of the gym areas was kind of segregated off because there was actually an orgy actually going on in one of them. Not everybody was participating, of course. And there was the kind of like the hotel section, which is where people were like sleeping and then, of course, doing other things that, of course, men and women naturally do when they're alone with each other. Just keep this PG-13 any more so than it already is. So, yeah, like with Aurora, that's kind of a very interesting example of like a larger venuum of sorts because even the construction of Aurora was very much done pretty discreetly with multiple contractors. And this was described by one of the members of the Agorist Revolutionary Cadre, the libertarian, you know, proprietarian anarchist people basically conducting counter-economic trade and such. So yeah, Aurora was actually a very interesting, albeit fictional, example of that kind of thing, where they did really have a one-directional isolationism with the Servile Society.
Indeed they did. Indeed they did. Let's move forward to another excerpt from Riley's book. Quote, "The higher maximum of satisfaction is attained by someone with a liberated home base plus some import-export with the Servile Society. For him, contact with the state is an occasional annoyance and danger, not a big part of his life. Thus, he can avoid the psychological paralysis that afflicts so many nonconformists. Compared to the opportunistic serf, he may enjoy somewhat fewer conveniences at present, but is happier overall. On the other hand, he has more than someone living in a primitive isolation required for 100% freedom," end quote. And that's written, same article, actually, no, not same article, November 17th, 1970, page 18 of that book. So any thoughts on that one? I mean, it kind of, I think one note that kind of comes to mind, and this, we talked about this in our controlled schizophrenia episode, but, you know, constant, you know, being, you know, immersed in, you know, the state of servile society, you know, as he said, psychological paralysis. The importance of the status, you know, of import-export is not only, you know, being able to survive, you know, if you kind of emulate Rayo and go live out in the woods or whatever. It's not only, you know, just the physical survival part, but it's also the psychological as well.
Yes, it is. And also consider the various collective movementists, collective movementism, see previous episode. Consider also the political crusaders, again, see previous episode on that topic. Those guys have their own psychological paralysis, don't they? It's not just the controlled schizophrenics, right?
True. Yeah,
so,
definitely.
Yeah, it is a little bit more widespread. And much like I said in at least one of those episodes, my own personal former conflicts, I like to think I have it under control now, but with the news cycle, because I've admitted before that I'm a former news junkie. So that being a news junkie was my own personal form of having a psychological paralysis. So when Rayo mentioned this in 1970, and then I read his book, you know, not too long ago, I think it was last year or thereabouts. Yeah, man, like, he was really on point. I know a lot of our episodes were constantly saying, man, Rayo was really right about things. I think we've only disagreed with him a few times thus far. But yeah, right here, psychological paralysis that afflicts so many nonconformists. He nailed it on this one. I mean, it's like freaky accurate, but in a good way.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and it definitely is accurate. We've got quite a few to get through, so I'm going to go ahead and get to this next one. Quote, "Freedom is not a monolithic entity. There are various degrees. But not all degrees are necessarily viable. For most people, I suspect that choices between predominantly servile, vulnerable lifestyles and predominantly liberated and vulnerable lifestyles." End quote. That same article, November 17th, 1970, page 19. So I'll go ahead and, because this, let's see, there's one other one I think here that's closely related to that one. Maybe not. But any thoughts on that one?
Yes, I think that's kind of an interesting dichotomy that I think the listener should take to heart and then consider whether they think Rayo was accurate about that or not. I personally think he was accurate about the, you know, predominantly servile or vulnerable lifestyles versus predominantly liberated or invulnerable lifestyles. I think the dichotomy is a real one. And it does explain quite a bit. In fact, there was also another quote, I'll loosely paraphrase because I'm doing this off the top of my head, where Rayo made a comparison about, can you really sympathize with somebody who built their house on like loose soil or sand, I think was what he said, on loose sand, as opposed to someone who built his house on a firm foundation of rock or something to that effect. And yeah, so yeah. What he was kind of getting at is that people voluntarily make lifestyle choices in such a manner that actually does affect the likelihood of whether they're going to be coerced or not, you know, later. And that is something, mm-hmm. See, that's kind of getting at the root of, you know, how do I put this? Okay, I won't say this nicely then. How personally responsible is someone for the tyranny that they experience, whether from the state or from private criminals or whomever? Because a lot of what you do, especially early on in your life, sets the stage or, you know, increases or decreases the likelihood for whether you're going to, you know, find yourself in the bad part of town, proverbially speaking.
Yeah. Yeah, that's definitely true. And I mean, I agree. I agree with you and also him that, you know, I think it is that dichotomy is actually accurate. Because, I mean, yeah, you can be free or you can be a slave. You can't be a free slave. You can't be a slave that is free, et cetera, et cetera. So I think this one, I'm not a big fan of dichotomies. I know you aren't either, Kyle, but with this, I think this one is very, very accurate. You cannot be free slave.
Right. And, for any of the listeners who may disagree with me on this point, my email address is kyle@vanupodcast.com.
Yes, it is. Montchainavanupodcast.com. Very good. Very good. Moving forward, quote, "We believe primitivism would mean less Vanu in the long run. Primitive societies run afoul of bludgeoning sooner or later. Consistent avoidance of something requires some knowledge of it. And there are too many capabilities, things we wish to develop, which require equipment, materials, and knowledge out of the other society. Technology our society doesn't have yet. But personal travel isn't necessary for import-export. All that is needed for now is a way to get parcels and messages in and out. Interfaces with the freighting and communication services of that society." End quote. And that was March 1972, page 81. But I think he's exactly right again. Because you consider the black market entrepreneurs, as Ray would call them, like, you know, ethical enclaves, or Samuel Konkin, you know, agorism. Just consider, you know, if agorism or agorism generally, or, you know, just individuals that practice agorism were, let's just say, you know, primitivists. Bitcoin and, you know, cryptocurrencies are a great tool to, you know, the black and gray markets. And without that technology, I mean, they would still, you know, have to, you know, use Federal Reserve notes, barter, and things of that nature. So what Ray was kind of arguing here is that, you know, the technology is a good thing. You know, technology can help you become more closer to Vanuism, you know, becoming invulnerable to coercion. So the import-export of that is, I mean, yeah, to develop Vanu further, you know, the technology can be a great, great help. And yeah, I mean, if you're living out there in a polyethylene A tent, you know, with your food storage and Zrayo with his typewriter, I mean, it's going to be really hard to, you know, come up with these really, really intricate technologies like Bitcoin or some of these altcoins or encryption, et cetera, et cetera. So there's still a necessity for the servile society as far as, you know, developing Vanu and, you know, surviving.
Right. And just because the transhumanists want to, you know, surgically implant brain chips between the hemispheres of their, well, brains, doesn't therefore mean technology as a whole is some sort of insidious, you know, entity or whatever, right? I mean, technology is a double-edged sword, isn't it? It can be used for good or it can be used for evil. Technology itself is neutral. In many ways, not to get too praxeological on everybody, and oh, by the way, I have been reading Ludwig von Mises' Human Action, okay? So for some reason, this is on the top of my head, of course. But, you know, money is neutral. It's just a tool. You can use it to either uplift people or you can use it to basically, like the state does, basically squish them down into dust and, well, use it for coercive purposes, right?
Yeah, you can use a hammer to, you know, build a house, or you can use a hammer to bash someone's skull in. I mean, the hammer, there's nothing good or bad about the hammer. It's just a tool.
Right. And so I think one major problem we keep seeing over and over again, at least I do, is that the crypto anarchists in particular really get a bad rap when they shouldn't. Really. I mean, it's I think it's just kind of obvious. And although I have my own, you know, very limited critiques, topic for another time, regarding issues of like security audits or free and open source software, that in itself is just something that can be remedied, right? And that's something I've kind of written on before in some of my other articles and such. So, but if you look at the crypto anarchists in general, I think there's a lot more positive than negative on the whole, because their whole thing is basically use technology, and more specifically use digital technology, to basically liberate the individual from the shackles of the state, and especially the surveillance state in particular. So I don't see why anybody really has that much of a problem with the crypto anarchists, but they do, whether it's a crypto anarchist like Cody Wilson, or even people who weren't necessarily crypto anarchists, but just like more hacktivist types like the late Aaron Schwartz, who, of course, pioneered the whole notion of open access, which is what many of us bloggers and podcasters kind of rely on. So when you folks...
That's what the BIPCOT license that you guys heard at the beginning of the show is based off of. It's essentially Creative Commons, only, you know, taken, you know, applied to the state too.
Yeah. And so, for example, when you folks, you know, go to vanupodcast.com and you can look at the articles that are there, which are sourced with hyperlinks, and you can, you know, grab these podcasts and whatever else, all of that is open access. There's no paywall, and you can thank men, not boys or children, but you can thank adult men like the late Aaron Schwartz, who would have been about 30 or so had he survived and not committed suicide due to federal persecution, because he was being coerced by government, of course. It was him and others like him that pioneered a lot of this technology that now a lot of us take for granted. I don't, because I know how important and significant it is, because I study this stuff and I, you know, learn things and such, and I encourage the audience to do that as well on their own time. So, you know, man, I don't know, technology being a bad thing? Who said? Really, honestly. You know, unless they're doing like forced microchipping or something, which would of course be done by government, the state, in terms of like forced microchipping, unless it's something like that, or something along those lines, I don't see technology being a bad thing, but technology in that case wouldn't be bad. It just would be used for bad purposes.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. You're exactly right. And Ray also recognized the importance of technology. I mean, there were some parts in his book. I mean, he kind of predicted the occurrence of cryptocurrencies. He mentioned, you know, underground banks, you know, with credits. I mean, a lot of people argue that cryptocurrencies aren't actually money. It's just, you know, data being exchanged, which was kind of what Ray was referring to in his book, which is mind blowing. And the 3D printing too. I mean, it's obviously not now. It's still got to be developed. I mean, the technology, it's expensive when it comes out, and then it gets cheaper and, you know, more widely used. But 3D printing could be a great tool. But the primitivists, you know, those folks who you live in the middle of the woods and have no contact with the state of servile society, are going to be a little outmatched. If they aren't already. So technology is definitely important, and that doesn't mean not to say it can't be, you know, developed in your Vanu home base. Not to say it can't, but I mean, when you consider like the ingenuity of hundreds of millions of individuals in this geographical location, more commonly known as the United States, I mean. yeah, there's a lot of technology that you would not have access to, and you know, technology that could very much so increase your pursuance of Vanu.
Yeah, and I would just kind of, you know, on this point, you know, because obviously this was might be more appropriate for season two, but just consider this as a parting thought regarding the technology question. Would it be accurate to say that technological innovation in the collective, or shall I say the long-term aggregate, that technological innovation more often than not actually benefits the individual more so than not?
I would say generally, yeah. But I think we'll probably cross that bridge, you know, season two or season three. But that's definitely an interesting question, and one that I recommend, you know, the listeners kind of think about and consider until we get to that point. Yeah, definitely a good question, something good to bring up. So this next quote here. Quote, in one sense, such a free man cannot be completely free since his import-export is restricted. Neither would be a resident of a utopian free country who traded with someone in Russia or America. Import-export is easier for extraterritorial freemen than for residents of another country, since controlling millions of square miles of interior is vastly more difficult than thousands of linear miles of border. In either case, with growth, import-export becomes relatively smaller and more in the hands of specialists at border crossings. The liberated home freeman, unlike the conventionally living libertarian, can segregate import-export from the rest of his life, essentially for development of durable, growing, joyous, free mini-cultures, end quote. And again, that one's from October 7th, 1970, page 15. So, Kyle, that kind of gets into the realm of, you know, country shopping. But here he is essentially highlighting how import-export can make you, you know, more vulnerable than not, which is kind of what we've been hammering home so far, just kind of at the beginning of this podcast. But yeah, country shopping could be very, very beneficial. I know we talked about, you know, making your money in, say, America and, you know, spending in the Bahamas. Because if you're spending in the Bahamas, I mean, if you're spending your money there, I mean, less likely to coerce you. And I mean, since you didn't make it there, you don't have to, you know, pay income tax on it or anything of that nature. So what are your thoughts on this one, Kyle?
I would just simply say that, yes, if you have a more developed import-export, I think it would be, you know, more... In a utilitarian sense, it would be a lot more easily usable, you know, over time once it gets better developed and all that. And again, when we get to season two and we get into self-seeking, okay?
Sailboats.
That's part of it. But when we get into self-seeking, even if we're not country shopping, which is the international stuff mainly, even if we're sticking to this portion of the North American continent from this latitude and longitude to that latitude and longitude, because that's what actually exists in reality, not America, which is just a political concept, sovereignty and all that. suffice it to say, man, yeah, I mean, whether it's the self-seeking version of like the local congregations or maybe even intentional community or one of those other things we'll cover in season two, I think it's rather interesting that even here, it would seem to be the case that, yeah, if there was like a growing concentration of the Nguyen's or other types of libertarians or what have you, that, yeah, import-export would be easier, wouldn't it?
Yeah, definitely, without a doubt.
Actually, division of labor, sorry, not to get praxeological again, division of labor, wouldn't it, right?
Specialization of labor, too. And I know Rayo talked about towards the end of the book later on in his development of Vanu, he did mention he's like, I've got quite a bit of money to spend, and there's things that I'd like to buy, and there are, you know, things I'd like to trade for services, but unfortunately that's just not here yet. Having more folks who are Vanuans where you can, you know, trade goods and services with, oh yeah, that can definitely assist you. For example, like if you're going on the sailboat route, and you have a nice little mini culture, Vanu mini culture, and you need repairs on your sailboat, you can go to a fellow Vanuan. You don't have to go to some statist outlet who's going to require you to pay taxes and such. So there's a lot of positives that come from having others to work with.
Yes, absolutely. And so I think that's just kind of something to kind of keep in mind, everybody, is that the import-export, at least for the immediate foreseeable future, is going to be somewhat limited in the sense that there's going to be a greater dependency on the servile society in the immediate future rather than later, where presumably if there was a growing number of Vanuans and especially more concentrated, shall we say, enclaves, okay, where then there can be a division of labor and labor specialization where some Vanuans would specialize in import-export, leaving other Vanuans available to do other things, right? Not to get too into economics here, but for those of you familiar with Ricardo's law of comparative advantage, like real free trade, for those of you familiar with the law of comparative advantage, that's exactly what I'm getting at here. I'm just applying comparative advantage not to these ridiculous, redundant, outdated, coercive nation states, so-called countries. I'm talking about law of comparative advantage as applied to individual human beings trying to become invulnerable to coercion, okay? That's what I'm kind of getting at. So for now, for the immediate foreseeable future, import-export in a lot of ways is a way of trying to maintain survivability despite the servile society, despite the state.
And I'll mention one other thing here. And we've been talking about, you know, the Vanu mini cultures, but like let's just say, I mean, that doesn't, you know, unfortunately, individuals, at least where you choose Devani, like let's say there's just not any other individuals like you, that's okay, because one thing Rayo kind of experienced is obviously, like, early on you make more trips to the State of Servile Society, and then once you get better and you get better at food storage and things of that nature, depending on what route you go, I'm just kind of speaking about Rayo's path right now. You can make less and less trips to the Servile Society. So let's say you make one big trip a year, and you have everything you need for the rest of the year. And the rest of that time, you're just maintaining your home base and doing whatever the hell you want to do. So it doesn't require the people necessarily, but just improving upon your import exports can definitely increase your invulnerability to coercion. And also, I mean, just your overall happiness too, which is more of a subjective term, and I don't want to kind of tie that in here too. But I know for me, if I could not go into cities more often, I know it would definitely improve my standard of living.
Yeah, let me just add on a personal anecdote before we keep going on here. You know, every single time the wife and I go to the grocery store here in town, right here in Austin, for me personally, and maybe other people will disagree with me about this, it's depressing as all hell. And it's not that things are getting worse. It's not like they've installed naked body scanners at the grocery store or something. Okay.
That'd be bad.
Okay. And I'm not saying, and I know the conspiracists would friggin' love stuff like that, 'cause it would give them, fodder for the news cycle or whatever. I'm just simply saying stuff like that isn't a reality, at least not yet. I guess I kind of feel like Rayo might.
It's the culture.
My tolerance, to sound like Rayo, because he mentioned this in part two of his, section two of his book, it's just my tolerance for their servile society is getting less and less. I am quite literally growing more intolerant of the servile society the longer I live. And so even being physically around them, like in the environs, let me just paint a quick picture before we continue. Like, even being in the aisles with that horrible lighting and the gosh gall darn awful music. Mm-hmm. Oh my gosh. It's, I've been in, this is going to sound awful and all the free market people are going to hate me for saying this. I have literally been in government buildings with better surroundings. Okay, a better atmosphere that was calmer, okay, and less frenetic and less, I don't know, man. I mean, maybe it's an issue of aesthetics. I don't know. Or maybe it's the particular grocery store chain. I don't know. We've actually tried some different ones. And to be fair, thankfully, there is a free market in food production. So we actually do kind of move around a bit. And I would say some are better than others. It's just, I don't know, man. I think it's an issue more of like social norms, at least to some extent. I mean, I know maybe some people would say, hey, get out of Austin. It's a blue area. Some people have literally said that to me, by the way, as if the voting, the politically crusading color of the week or whatever is what matters. It's like, okay, and I could also be in friggin' Portland, Oregon, too. Or I could be in I don't know, man. I'm starting to think that maybe, it's these urban areas, or at least some of them might be, I mean, if you really think about coercion, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but aren't really coercive areas, if we're going to divide them up geographically, isn't like a lot of coercion like happening in the cities?
Yes. Yes, it is. And that I want to read this. We'll sidle out for a moment because we're going to come back to it right after this quote but by Rayo, because it fits in perfectly. So just stand by for one moment here, Kyle. Quote, more and more people are rejecting the attitudes and roles of the servile society. While only a small minority of the whole population, they number in the tens of thousands. Some attempt to turn back the clock by moving to farms or small towns, but rural dwellers are conspicuously unfree. So those who really want freedom will search in other directions, end quote. And that was from September 1972, page 92. And to answer your question, the majority of people, they live in cities. And I've mentioned, in other podcasts and things, maybe in this one too, I don't recall off the top of my head. But I guess my next step after, I continue forward in the frugality and financially independent early retirement path, what I want to do is, move down to, we own some property in Southern Illinois. And, it's probably, I don't know, 15, there's a small town about five minutes away, but it's like a town of 50 people. No police force, obviously. Unfortunately, they're a bunch of rednecks on welfare, which is not good. And they have a lot of Hillary Clinton signs around there. Not that that really makes a big difference, but just an observation. I want to move out there. I want to move out there. And yeah, unfortunately, there would be, you know, property titling and all, which would be, you know, unvanu, according to Rayo. But yeah, as you kind of said, Kyle, considering where physically most people live. And, you know, where the bludgies hang out, you know, those police extortionists, moving to a rural area automatically makes you more invulnerable to coercion. You know, lower crime rates, you know, again, less bludgies, no bludgies out there where I want to move to. But yeah, we'll broach those other issues in season 2 and 3. But I don't know, man, even with the property titling, I mean, in the 25 years, I've been going down there for almost 25, but my parents have owned property down there for 25 years. There's never been a cop. Never. Ever. So I think automatically moving out of the cities makes you more invulnerable to coercion. What do you think?
I think that there is a general tendency towards that way. I mean, maybe there are exceptions to that. And again, if you like to send what you might think are the exceptions to that, my email is kyle@vanupodcast.com. But seriously, man, I know that Rayo says here the one sentence about, but rural dwellers are conspicuously unfree. And all I'm thinking is, based on what, man? I don't know. I'm not 100% on this, but I'm leaning towards Rayo might be wrong about that one specific observation. Because I don't know, dude. I mean, there are off-grid homesteaders right now. You know, people who don't, you know, have sewage, people who aren't plugged into the electrical grid, people who don't have cable. The issue of internet is interesting. I don't want to get too in the weeds here. Some people have internet, some people don't. And usually they have to either bum off either the Wi-Fi or they have to use satellite internet and pay for that. But generally speaking, there are off-grid homesteaders right now. And the interesting question is, would something, for example, like off-grid homesteading make you more or less vulnerable to coercion? And for whatever reason, Rayo's kind of making an assumption. And to be fair, okay, he's talking about like in the 60s and 70s, okay? And I'm talking more about off-grid homesteading now in the 2010s, okay? So there is a time difference. There's a technological difference. Okay, and that's I don't want to nail Rayo to a cross here, just for the listeners. I just want to keep in mind here,
especially not on that like one minor point. Yeah.
Yes,
go ahead.
But I would say now in the 2010s, I don't know, man. The off-grid homesteaders have their own challenges because of the kind of thing that they're trying to pursue. But in terms of like vulnerability to coercion, I'm leaning more towards they're more likely than not to be invulnerable, as opposed to, again, I mean, in terms of like the in terms of like population density, I don't know, would you rather be a country mouse or a city rat?
And you make a good point there, because like obviously whatever lifestyle choice you decide to make, if you decide to pursue Vanu, they're all going to come with their own set of challenges. Living in a city, you're gonna deal with, you know, the psychological aspect. You're going to deal with more government, more government agents. And if you live off grid, you're gonna have to, you know, figure out. If one of your passive income streams is, you know, like a blog with advertising. You're going to have to find a way to get internet. You're going to have to find a way for power and all that stuff. They all just come with different sets of challenges. Now I will say this, and this is an anecdotal example, but going down there to our property, and you know, for the past, you know, almost 25 years of my life, I mean, obviously the first like 5 years don't really count, but we'll just go with it. I have noticed, Kyle, that the country folk that I've known for forever, they tend to be more happy. They tend to be, you know, a lot more friendlier, because they don't deal with, you know, the assholes that unfortunately I deal with on a daily basis. They don't get people out there often. So when we go down there, where I'll be next week, they're just happy as all hell to see us, and they're just the nicest folks. And you don't really get that a lot in the, obviously there are exceptions. This isn't, you know, a hard rule, but generally, I mean, people that I meet on public aren't generally friendly. So I think that's more of the psychological aspect too. But I think that there definitely are some benefits, even if Rayo, you know, he does point out some issues, you know, with purchasing private property and stuff. But I do think generally, you know, moving out to a rural area is definitely a beneficial thing, and it definitely makes you more invulnerable to coercion, at least in some regards. But anything else on that, Kyle?
I would just simply say this. When it comes to the servile society, most of the inhabitants of said servile society, as a matter of fact, according to the CIA World Factbook, it's something like, what, 80, 85% of the total American population is urbanized? So most of the inhabitants of said servile society, I guess you could say mainstream America, are city rats. Okay, that's very important when we're trying to make decisions about, you know, trying to increase invulnerability. Okay, so even now, obviously, when we get into season two, and there's going to be the issue about doing Vanu in the cities, which is something I'm looking forward to in particular, because I think it can be at least an alternative to off-grid homesteading, or perhaps even parallel to it. Maybe some people could bounce back and forth between the two, right? I mean, the dichotomy between city rat and country mouse, there's also the third option of why not do both. We'll get to that in season two. I just think it's rather interesting that when you consider the servile society's inhabitants and the coercion that they can inflict upon you, remember, it's not just about the bludgies, okay? You also have to consider snitches, informants, provocateurs, like the provocateurs in Portland, Oregon, just the other month, where they were blocking traffic.
Violators of property rights.
They were blocking traffic, literally. And it was, and in terms of legality, for people who care about that, it was actually illegal for them to do so. And the cops didn't, the bludgies didn't even come along until like hours and hours and hours later to, you know, clear the roads and such, so that people could like get home from work, because this was going on for hours and hours and hours. I mean, that's how friggin' lawless they are. Okay. So the coercion doesn't always come from the state. The coercion can also come in the form of organized crime syndicates, or as the case was here, disingenuous activists blocking traffic.
Yeah. And let me bring this back to, import-export real quick and kind of just make one note in regards to, you know, rural living. Obviously, depending upon how far away you are from a city, you might not be able to find, a 9-to-5 job. Or you may have to travel, you know, significantly more distance to get to those. It'll kind of at least for my projected path, I'll have to become a lot more self-sufficient. And I think that's a good thing. But again, the import-export aspect may be a little more difficult the further away you are from a city. But again, the more Vani you become, the less you'll have to interact, and the less you'll have to, import and export. I guess, Kyle, anything else before we move on to this final quote, which you kind of already paraphrased a little bit, but I'll read it anyways, just for the sake of the listeners.
I would just say this. When it comes to the servile society, it does include the state, but it's not limited to it. So you have the state, and then including that, but going beyond that into more the realm of like culture, is the servile society. And Vanuans are specifically against the servile society. So in terms of import-export, that is a way of trying to provide for survivability of us who want to be invulnerable to coercion, or shall I say, pursuing Vanuans, you know, in the process of achieving an invulnerability to coercion. Import-export allows us to pursue Vanuans in a way to where we maintain our integrity. Sorry, I don't mean to do me, we, right? We did the collective movementism episode, right? Where I and others like me are basically trying to preserve whatever integrity each one of me, us, damn it. See, plural pronouns are can be really kind of annoying.
Whip.
whip, right? Okay.
It's understandable. I mean, I notice it, but I, okay, I but think the import, yeah, we've already done that.
Okay,
yeah.
So the import-export is basically a way for us to maintain our integrity while still surviving despite the servile society. So if there's any one takeaway from this particular episode is that import-export has a very utilitarian function while also being philosophically consistent, because we're not bowing before the servile society. We're specifically against it. But until we have better infrastructure and the Venuums grow larger to the extent where we have things like an Aurora or things similar to that, but it's real world, not just some, you know, something from libertarian fiction. Until that time, import-export is going to be quite important, and it's not going to be as well developed as, well, I personally would like it to be.
Indeed, indeed. So let me read this final quote real quick. So, one who continues in a vulnerable lifestyle and then complains when he is plundered is somewhat like a West Indies resident who builds a flimsy house and then blames the next hurricane for demolishing it. Certainly, people are to blame when they inflict coercion, but merely blaming them does not bring liberty. The self-responsible person builds a home which can withstand likely storms and develops a way of life not vulnerable to likely attempts at predation, end quote. And again, that's from his November 17th, 1970 article, page 17. And this does represent the servile society. I mean, obviously, we kind of mentioned the collective movementism thing and the political crusading. You know, there are plenty of people complaining about, you know, the lack of freedom, right? But are they really doing anything to, you know, increase their own personal freedom? Obviously, the political crusaders go political crusading. The collective movement, movementism folks, kind of do the same thing, or they don't, and they just fail for other reasons. But these people these individuals are willfully choosing to be more vulnerable. Now, no one's forcing them to stay in the cities. No one's forcing them to, you know, run for office. At least not yet. Wouldn't that be weird?
Oh, God, please no.
But yeah, it's a choice. It's a choice. And as we've kind of been saying, you know, that throughout the first nine episodes of this podcast, I mean, that lifestyle choices are very important. And they can, you know, determine whether you will, you know, live free as a Vanuan or whether you'll live as a slave in the servile society. Now, I don't like putting it that way, but I mean, it's just you know, cold hard truth. It just is, unless you're going to Vanuan cities, which that one may sound a little confusing. If you read the book, you'll kind of understand where Rio is coming from. But Vanuan in cities may seem like an odd concept, but we'll definitely develop that further. But anything on that quote, Kyle?
Yeah, I would just say this. When you look at those individuals who make up the servile society, they really are good Germans. Oh, wait, I'm sorry, good Americans. Oh, wait, hold on a second. I actually did mean it. They are good Germans. And people really should feel insulted when they hear that, especially coming from me. Because there is a historical connotation about what a good German was. You know, people who actually supported the friggin' National Socialists, who were socialists.
The ones that sent the individuals into gas chambers and such, yeah.
Or whatever else. I mean, I know some people have their own issues as to what actually happened or didn't happen. I will just say this. The National Socialists, who were socialists, because people keep forgetting about that, which is why I emphasize it. The National Socialists terrorized men like Ludwig von Mises, okay?
Yep.
They murdered people, murders, democide that's not contested, okay? So when people praise the system as it is, the Anglo-American Empire would be one way of describing it. Other people call it the New World Order. Pick a phrase. We're pretty much describing roughly the same thing. They are basically good Americans, which is basically the modern version of being a good German. And you people are good Germans, and I have nothing in common with you because you worship the servile society, you praise the state, and you basically are heralding quite literally the extinction of the human species such as it is.
And just to add one clarification, Kyle's not talking to you, the listeners, the Vanu podcast. He's just he's talking generally.
Sorry, I should have made that disclaimer.
I know quite a few of you that listen, and yeah, you guys aren't doing that. So just add a point of clarification, a little bit of monologuing or however you would put it. But yeah, he's not talking about you specifically. He's just talking.
Although I will add this as a secondary disclaimer, or at least a notice of sorts for those of you know, good listeners and such, who are at least giving us the time of day, if not also agreeing with us at least to some extent. I would suggest that you probably should look around at people that you're associating with and try to, well, gauge as best as you can using your own judgment whether they are good Americans, the modern good Germans, and basically just try to evaluate, are they really good Americans? And then, you know, hopefully you'll maybe find some, I don't know, what's the opposite? I mean, what would we be? Maybe bad Americans? I don't know.
Well, hey, if that's what it is, I'm proud to be a bad American.
Yeah, you're a terrible American, Shane, and that's the nicest compliment I'll ever give you.
Indeed, indeed. But yeah, essentially what Ray was trying to get across there is that, yeah, people choose these lifestyles. You know, I mean, they can't, when they decide to, oh, I don't know, live in a city and you know, advocate for the state and a bunch of other, you know, terrible things, they can't, you know, complain whenever the state actually comes and gets them. I mean, you don't, like, for example, maybe it's a bad one, but you can tell me if it is, Kyle, but, you know, starting a legal business and then, you know, complaining when the government comes for tax dollars, I guess it might be one example. I mean, you can't really complain about that, right?
No, because they went and they submitted before authority, right? And I understand that they're being coerced by laws and such, but you know, I wrote a separate article on this. People can look at it if they really want to, but the notion of carefully calculated submission. And the very short version of that is that if you do decide to obey the laws, and not just the laws generally, but like a specific one, okay? The key part is not so much the submission, it's the carefully calculated part, in that you choose to obey a specific law because you have, well, carefully calculated that it is in your own best interest to do so at this time. Maybe later you'll disobey it. I don't know. I mean, that's on you, okay?
And that goes right along with what Rayo discussed, especially with, you know, the legal interstices of the Van Nomadism. But yeah, go ahead.
Exactly. And so that's kind of something interesting a lot of people really don't think about. So without getting into legal interstices too much, what I'll just simply say here regarding the Servile Society is that, generally speaking, yes, in early 21st century America, with a K, quite a lot of one's personal life, even professional life to some degree, right, is voluntary by and large. Even despite the federal government and the several state governments and so forth, generally speaking, a lot of your life is voluntary, right? We are not exactly like the kulaks or Soviet citizens, although there are actually way too many accurate comparisons, to be perfectly frank with you. But
yeah, like you and I could leave America if we wanted to. Like we could leave
love it or
at,
leave
at
it.
This at this point we could. Now if that wall gets built and you know immigration continues to be built up, I mean it might be a little more difficult. But anyways, yeah,
hey,
go ahead. That's a subject for another time.
Ludwig von Mises left Austria when the National Socialists were welcomed in by the good Austrians, who were exactly like the good Germans of their time. And Mises was like, holy crap, I'm trying to talk about free markets and money and trade and like living in peace and prosperity. Holy crap, I got to get out of here.
They'll put my head on a pike.
Yeah, it was probably a good thing he did leave because he was not like a gorilla. And it's probably better that he did choose to leave so that he can go and write books and stuff like Human Action, which came out after the war. Okay, you know, Ayn Rand left the Soviet Union, okay, when she could, came here to America all by herself. And Mises and Rand, you know, their first language was not English. She spoke Russian. I believe he spoke probably German, right, being an Austrian. So, yeah, that's kind of interesting. So when all of these disgusting political crusaders of one flavor or another tell us to love it or leave it, I have a better idea. Why don't they leave? And yeah, I know them's fighting words. I know that. That's not the point. The point is that they're good Americans, the modern good Germans, who revel in the servile society and are trying to coerce me and my fellow peaceful men to basically lick the boot and kiss the ring. And I say no. Enough. It's time to have our own second realm of our own infrastructure and our own culture, preferably a culture of liberty, or Vanu, if you will, and push that forward, because quite frankly, Shane, nobody is coercing anybody to watch the Oscars. Nobody's coercing anybody to watch a stupid football game. People make choices when they engage in so-called cultural activities like that, don't they?
Yeah, definitely. Without a doubt, yeah. Yeah, speaking for like for the NFL specifically, I mean, yeah, there's a lot of statism there. Obviously, you know, you consider the stadiums that get a lot of taxpayer money, and then the other government money, so that they, you know, promote the worship of the state. So yeah, it's you're definitely
stand
things
for
like
the
that
national
is,
anthem.
Yep.
Oh, say, can you put us in prison? We are political prisoners. Okay. Excuse my bad singing, but okay, I'm kind of going off the cuff here. But seriously, I mean, It's just like, look, guys, I was a Boy Scout, okay? I've been there. I've done that. I have quite literally worn the uniform and earned my way up through the ranks, okay? Without getting too much of my own personal life. I've been there. I've done that. It's not a pretty picture at all. There is a reason I have a specific disgust of conservatives. I don't like progressives either because they're, you know, they're good Americans too. But conservative, I mean, let me put it this way. The progressives will impoverish you and put you in the poorhouse and make you homeless and unemployed and such. But the conservatives will just enslave you, incarcerate you, and even kill your ass. And so if we're being honest here about coercion and trying to become invulnerable to said coercion, which is what Vanu is all about, I think it's also pretty, it's time to get pretty honest here about the servile society and how really dangerous it is to be surrounded by literally hundreds of millions of people on this continent who, if under the right circumstances, would be willing to snitch on you without batting an eyelash. So there was a reason why Rayo kept mentioning about you need to vet people, you need to have something resembling a security culture, and you need to be, and you basically need to, you know, how did else did he put it, Shane? I'm trying to remember, like, give up these dreams of, like, worldwide utopian free societies and get with each other and our little Vanuims and Vanuist mini cultures, to loosely paraphrase it. There was a reason Rayo was getting on that, because I think he understood much of what I just explained to y'all.
Yeah, yeah, and I guess I'll add one more anecdotal example, and then we'll kind of begin to close out here. But yeah, I was in high level indoctrination, you know, whereas in the state of servile society, they call that college, but I don't. but yeah, high level indoctrination. Yeah, I went there until just December of 2016, and I'll tell you what, being around psychopathic socialists who want to further the extortion of my property, of my labor, and the fruits of it, and I'll tell you what, it was very, very tough. I think the only way I made it through, at least as far as I did, until I thankfully stopped, was largely my Adventures in Illinois Higher Education series that I wrote on that. It kind of helped keep my sanity. It really did, and also, you know, reading Human Action, Kyle. In class definitely helped as well, but yeah, it's you know, there's something to say about you know, limiting, even if it's not you know, to the point of Vani, so to speak. But as we've kind of talked about before, cutting ties to the state is good, and then cutting ties to the servile society is good too. So if like for me, one of those ties was, you know, high level indoctrination, and you know, I stopped that, and I've A lot happier. Well, a lot less stress. Now I do have, you know, a 9-to-5 job, but politics is not discussed there. So it's a world of difference. There are no vote for Hitler, vote for Stalin, vote for Gary Johnson. There's nothing like that. So there's something to be said about cutting those ties to the servile society, as you very well could, and I would say probably should do. In regards to the state.
Hold on, let me actually just point out something you just highlighted. You're already doing import-export, aren't you? Just with how you exactly... So actually, let's as we begin to close out here, let's actually, you know, use what you just said as a perfect example. You're not talking about politics at work, but you are exporting your labor, so then you can then take those paychecks or what have you, and then import, you know, goods and knowledge and whatever else you need to pay your bills and whatever else, you know, savings of capital and so forth and whatever else you're doing in your personal life that we'll not go into here publicly. Okay. So you're doing import export right now.
I am, yes, but I don't want to use like a 9-to-5 job as an example for Vanu, because then pretty much anybody could be, you know, doing import export. And yeah, from the definition, they very well could be, but there's not that, you know, that philosophical or ideological, you know,
there's also those taxes.
That's kind of putting it too simply. It's almost akin to, you know, calling everyone who you know, buys something from a garage sale an agorist. So I know what you mean. I know what you mean. But you know, I will just to point that out for the listeners. You know, I just say that, you know, that's everyone would be a Vanu. Everyone, well, maybe not a Vanu specifically, but everyone would be participating in import export if that was kind of the baseline. But yes, you are correct. But I think that's a little oversimplification, if just as my thoughts.
And it's definitely not exactly the context of which Rayo is offering it, right? Because of course, to use the 9-to-5 as an example, right? There's all sorts of taxes and regulations, what the agorists would call white market, right, as opposed to gray market. There's all of that. So yes, your criticism actually is well founded, because you're basically pointing out that describing a 9-to-5 is just over broke. That's how I think about jobs, folks. That a 9-to-5 just over broke is basically the same as exporting labor. It's like, arguably, but then you also have to consider, you know, the taxes, federal income tax, social security taxes, this tax, that tax, all of the regulations, never mind, oh, yeah, the lack of privacy at work, which I know a lot of people are concerned about, workplace surveillance and a couple other things related to that. Whenever you fill out job applications and you have job interviews, let's go through your entire history ever since you were in diapers. Sometimes it feels that invasive and so forth. So, yes, you know what, Shane? I will take your criticism on the chin. You're actually right.
as an example, another example of import-export, I don't think it was bad, but I want to just make that point very clear that, not the baseline. But yeah, let's begin to close out here. So it's not so much as, opposing the state, but the broader issue is avoiding the servile society. As I kind of just mentioned, limiting my time in the servile society, I spent a lot of time at home. When I'm not at work, I'm here at home, working after I get off work, right? Because that's life in the alternative media. I'm either doing that or, going down to our property and saying, I don't know why. I don't do a whole lot because I try to limit my interaction with the servile state of society. Obviously the invulnerability coercion aspect is the point of the show, but it's also, I don't like being there. So yeah, avoiding the servile society, and it's also, getting away from bullshitters and sheep people, as Rayo called them, in his book. There's a massive cultural difference. Now, like Kyle and I, when we have discussions, small talk may consist of a very small fraction of the conversation, but generally, we're talking shop 95% of the time. When you go out to the servile society, if you're going to go out around election time, you're talking about politics and who they're going to, who they hope will be their next slave master. It's a massive cultural difference. What's discussed, what you want to discuss, if you are, a Vonnegut or, even just, a proprietarian anarchist or something like that, a lot of those conversations probably won't interest you at all. I know they don't really interest me much either. So,
hi, you're mentioning time preference.
Yes, I guess so. Any thoughts on that one?
No, just that you're mentioning time preference for all of the Austro-libertarian fans in the crowd. Just saying that.
Indeed. So, and Kyle, you kind of mentioned earlier on about, you don't like the atmosphere of grocery stores, but you have an issue with consumerism, and I do too to some extent. I mean, I am practicing frugality now, but consumerism would be crucial to the servile society, wouldn't it?
Yes, and remember, consumerism is actually anti-free market because it's all about tricking people to engage in conspicuous consumption, or as Tyler Durden from Fight Club put it, another fictional thing, of course, basically it's about tricking people into working jobs they hate, into buying shit they don't need in order to impress people they don't like. Okay, it's a con game. In other words, it's a form of fraud, but it's one that people kind of voluntarily I say that with gritted teeth. It's true, but I don't like saying it, but it's true that people voluntarily allow themselves to be tricked because it appeals to their base desires about, ooh, shiny new car. Ooh, there's someone, someone who's presumably attractive of the opposite sex. Sorry, folks, most people are heterosexual. Someone who's attractive of the opposite sex with a makeup or bulging muscles, if that's your thing or whatever. Or the big house with a 30-year mortgage attached to it and all of that kind of stuff. I mean, whatever is promoting that kind of blind consumerism where, and here's the part where the fiscal conservatives in the crowd should really care about, it's all about putting people in debt. Okay. And so you can't really claim to value even the notion of freedom. An absence of coercion. You can't even really claim to value freedom of any kind if You're basically kind of saying, well, consumerism is like this version of market activity, when in fact it's not. It's all about tricking people into making foolish purchasing decisions so that they'll be put into debt to banks, who, oh, by the way, are all part of the Federal Reserve System. Anyway, I mean, come on, people, wake up.
Yeah, 2 points. I don't know how many, first one, I don't know how many fiscal conservatives are going to be listening to the Vonnie podcast. Hopefully there's some out there. If you are, just let us know. I'd like to know more about our audience. and then second, Kyle, I mean, consumerism would kind of be, I guess, obviously it's adaptable to, you know, your lifestyle. But I would say that, you know, consumerism is anti-Vonnie, especially when you consider the debt aspect.
Oh, yeah.
Now, like, if let's say you're vonning in cities, which we'll get to later on, and you have, we'll talk about it a little bit in the next episode, one kind of example of this. Now, if you have, if you're vonning in a city and you are an industrial park and you have, like, an underground hidden apartment or something, and you have a lot of really, really nice stuff there, I mean, okay, like, if that's your thing, and, you know, you like spending money on that sort of stuff, I'd say that would still be Vonnie. But I'd find it hard to believe that if you're doing, like, the tiny house thing, or if you're, doing van nomadism, or what Rayo did in a polyethylene A10, everything was pretty much stored in your pickup truck whenever you're relocating it. I'd have a hard time believing that you could, like, you know, pack all that shit up and, like, move quickly. Because, you know, mobility was very important to Rayo as far as, you know, being invulnerable to coercion. So, obviously, that the points you brought up, Kyle, I think are fair and valid. But also just, you know, relating this strictly to Vonnie, I think there's also that issue there. And I just don't think consumerism is really possible, except for that one example I mentioned about vonning in cities.
Right, and interesting you mentioned the mobility. Yeah, it's a little hard, ladies and gentlemen, to have any sort of real mobility if all or nearly all of your earthly possessions basically are so numerous and vast that they fill up every nook and cranny of a McMansion. Okay, so as much as I personally don't exactly care for the so-called minimalists, I will say this. I think the minimalists were right in the sense of, like, paring your possessions down to the extent because, and this is something they don't say, is actually it helps you be more mobile. And so in a kind of roundabout way, the minimalists actually work, to be perfectly fair, were actually correct in saying that, you know, maybe you should consider having less possessions rather than more. Now, obviously, they get a little mystical for my tastes. And some other directions, which tend to be more a little bit to the left there, right? Just a little bit. But I would say, like, yeah, you were mentioning mobility. Yeah, it's a little hard to be mobile, you know, with a van or a truck or much of anything else. If basically you're basically essentially hoarding. I hate to use that term. I can't think of how else to put it. But essentially hoarding all of this junk, all of this stuff that you're not even using regularly, but you're just stuffing because, as some of the minimalists also correctly say, you don't have meaningful relationships with other human beings. So instead you've chosen voluntarily to basically a lot of times go into debt in order to have these pseudo non-relationships with these friggin' cheap Chinese crap. I'm sorry. It's about time a few people have had a stern talking to. And for those of you, you know, listeners of ours, if you happen to know somebody who's got really nasty credit card debt because they just buy, send them a copy of this episode because they need to hear this.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think one kind of final point to mention here is this is about import-export. Now, I would say, you know, kind of, you know, thinking about this now, most stuff you would purchase from the Servile Society would be out of necessity. Now I imagine, like, if Freyo could come across, like, I don't know, let's just say, like, an alternative, like, a, you know, parallel universe, and he could have come across, like, a laptop or something. Like, I think he might have, like, splurged at that opportunity or something. A lot of it's out of necessity, and then also, you know, just tools that, you know, could potentially, you know, help further develop Vonnie. So it's not the consumerist notion of, you know, like, you know, just one. It's not crucial. It's not crucial at all. It's just, you know, spending money for the sake of spending money. I think there could be a little bit of, you know, splurging, like, like for Rayo again, like, if he could have, like, bought a laptop or, you know, what was the evolution after a typewriter? Actually, that wouldn't be very fun because you know those big ass computers that they used to have.
Yeah.
I guess
not
that
very
wouldn't
mobile
be.
Maybe, at the very least.
Maybe that's a bad example. But but again, if there's a tool that you know could further develop Vanu, I think like you know for me personally, I'd probably you know invest in that if I had the money. I think Raya would have too. But it's I guess it's kind of, it's not premised about premised around you know want. It's premised around necessity and what can further develop Vanu. You know, for just in my personal opinion.
Well, yes. And so really all I'm saying is that when it comes to one's, you know, private property and your own personal possessions and so forth, just be very, not to get spiritual on anybody, but be very mindful and conscientious about what property you do own. Because if you do decide to engage in venuance, one thing that you're going to have to make a decision on, and many of you will probably go this way, is that you'll want to be more mobile than not. And if you do choose to go mobile, especially in the form of country shopping, although not limited to that, right, because there's also van nomadism, is that if you do choose to be more mobile, you can't have that many things. I'm sorry. The minimalists were right about that. You cannot move around easily if you have literally thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of stuff to your name. So there is a reason for... you know, certain technologies that have been developed to help facilitate individual selling off of people's, you know, garage sales like digitally online and such. So there's a reason why a lot of that was developed was because people were trying to pare down so they could be more mobile for one reason or another. And a lot of times it was so that they could have better, more freedom or, as for our purposes, better Vanu.
Indeed, indeed. So I guess just one other thing, as we've said many times, I mean, the choice is up to you. No one's, you know, forcing you to live in the cities. No one's forcing you to, you know, remain vulnerable to coercion. Obviously, there's some of that that's out of your control, you know, especially legal exercises and things. But as we kind of said, generally, I mean, the choice is up to you. If you want more freedom, if you want to become more invulnerable to coercion, the choice is yours. I mean, there are options out there. And obviously, it's still me. I mean, this is Rayo developed this for 15 or so years and wrote about it, and he continued after that. I would presume we don't know for sure, but I mean, this is something that can be further developed. And yeah, I mean, the choice is yours. The choice is yours.
Right. And one thing also I'd like to add too, if people want to kind of conceptualize the servile society in the form of an equation, I think it would probably be best to consider it this way. And obviously, this is obviously tying into the three previous episodes we've done. Political crusading plus controlled schizophrenia plus collective movementism equals the servile society.
Yes, and you guys probably figure out why we laid out the episodes in this way, huh?
There was a reason, folks. There was a reason from A to B to C to D and so forth, right? So... I mean, the servile society is the enemy of venuance. I mean, that's just straight up what it is. And you know what? I wish life wasn't like this. I wish our fellow humans weren't so easily willing to coerce their fellow man. I can wish all I want, but wishing doesn't make it so. This is the world as it is. A is A. And so the only question then at that point is, how do you deal with it? And hence, Vanu, and of course, TVP.
Indeed, and well said. Well said. So, that's all we have for you. The website is vanupodcast.com. That's spelled V as in Victory, O, N as in Nancy, U, vanupodcast.com. Thanks so much for tuning in. We'll talk to you next week. We'll be right back.
www.thebeatpodcast.com.